you had the picture of someone with extreme force using some sort of weapon. It was a very violent assault.
Initially, there was no idea who had been the source of the blood at that crime scene.
I think the more we realise that we were dealing with the epitome of a sexual predator and a serial killer.
Welcome to Murder Time and the Crime Stories Control Room. Today, I've pulled an international story from our world-famous vault of true crime interviews. I'll be introducing you to some very clever investigators who face a big problem as they try to bust a brutal bludgeoner. It's late winter in Australia, August 1998. We're in a city called Rockhampton on the northwestern coast, and we're in conversation with Darren Lees. Lees is a detective, senior constable with the Rockhampton Criminal Investigation Branch. He shares a bit about his city.
It was one of those places where the kids used to ride their bikes to school, and the parents used to drop their kids at sporting events and that sort of thing and not think twice that they'd be safe.
On this sunny morning, Jenny Ryan drops her daughter Natasha off at school. When she returns to pick Natasha up, the 14-year-old doesn't show. As night falls, Jenny Ryan calls police. Queensland Police Detective Sergeant David Hickey.
There was evidence of some minor drug use by Natasha. She was unhappy at school. So, yeah, she was a troubled teenager.
Detectives Lees and Hickey waste no time, rolling up on Scott Black, Natasha's boyfriend. Scott's been caught hiding Natasha in the past. But on this day, he tells cops he hasn't seen her. For Jenny Ryan, the agony of a missing child grows. Days turn to weeks.
As the investigation went on, police became aware that the likelihood of her being alive was very minimal. Her parents became aware then that foul play had probably struck Natasha.
Hope for the teenager fades. 4 long months pass. Then a second Rockhampton woman disappears.
Do you have a cabinet full of acne treatments and skincare products, but don't even remember what half of them do? It's always been a struggle to navigate skincare products, and for me, it's been especially difficult finding acne treatment products that work from a very young age. I'm not a dermatologist. Most of us aren't. So I was wasting so much money based on friends' opinions and advertising, but not actually knowing what my skin really needs. Turns out, most skincare products don't do much. The best way to treat acne is with fewer products that are clinically proven and customized to your skin. That's why I'm thrilled to partner with Apostrophe. Apostrophe is a prescription skincare company that offers science-backed oral and topical medications that are clinically proven to help clear acne. Apostrophe connects you with a board-certified dermatologist who will create a personalized treatment plan that is perfectly tailored to your unique skin. Simply fill out Apostrophe's online quiz about your skin goals and medical history. Then snap a few selfies and your dermatologist will create your customized treatment plan. Apostrophe treats acne, and they can also help you hit your other skincare goals, like reducing redness, wrinkles, and even dark spots. My skin has suffered during the pandemic, and I can attribute it to wearing a mask. It was getting out of control. It was amazing to get a customized system to get this under control. At the end of the day, like most people, I want to have clear skin, blemish-free, and Apostrophe's system helps set you up with a more informed understanding of your skin's needs. We have a special deal for our audience. Save $15 off your first visit with a board-certified dermatologist at apostrophe.com/crime when you use our code CRIME. This code is only available to our listeners. To get started, just go to apostrophe.com/crime and click Begin Visit. Then use our code CRIME at sign up and you'll get $15 off your dermatology visit. That's apostrophe.com/crime. And use that code CRIME to get your dermatology visit and save $15.
and we thank Apostrophe for sponsoring the podcast. Julie Turner is an outgoing 39-year-old. She's the life of the party. In the last days of 1998, Julie goes missing. This is her daughter, Kylie Elder.
She liked to be around people. She'd go out into town and go and sing karaoke.
Julie's last seen leaving the Airport Liberties Lounge at closing time, 2 a.m. Julie's boyfriend, Michael, calls Kylie Elder the next day.
The only reason why he rang me was to find out whether Mum was with me or what she was doing, but I didn't know. I rang him the next day and he still hadn't heard from her.
Rockhampton Detective Sergeant David Hickey interviews people close to Julie.
None of her friends had heard from her, including her daughter. She'd failed to attend work.
And Detective Hickey discovers there's trouble in Julie's love life.
She had informed several of her friends that her relationship was definitely coming to an end, and she was looking for ways of moving out of the relationship.
The turbulence in the romance turns up the heat on live-in boyfriend Michael McConaughey. But Michael's alibi is airtight.
I just knew something was really wrong because she wouldn't ring me. It's just not Mum not to call me.
There were fears held for Julie's welfare.
But again, the case cools with no leads. On March 2nd, 1999, a woman finds a handbag beside the Fitzroy River. She turns it in to police. The purse belongs to another local woman, Beverly Lego. A few calls reveal Beverly's also gone missing. Hickey digs into her background.
At the time, she'd been living in the Mount Morgan area, which was a lower socioeconomic type area outside of Rockhampton.
Beverly's parents reckon her boyfriend, ex-con Richard Gritt, may be behind the disappearance. But Gritt, just like Scott Black and Michael McConaughey, comes up squeaky clean. Now three women, Natasha Ryan, Julie Black, and Beverly Lego, are disappeared. The Rockhampton police set up a missing victims task force. Sergeant David Hickey.
At that particular time, there were lines of inquiry being conducted separately, but there was officers looking at common threads between the investigations.
On April 22nd, 1999, the pressure on Hickey, Lees, and their missing victims task force ratchets up. That's the day little Kira Steinhardt is dropped off at school by her mother, Teresa.
Kira was a 9-year-old schoolgirl who lived with her mother and stepfather in a house at North Rockhampton. Her mother describes her as a very forthright and cheeky young girl, one who was at the same time well-mannered but knew what she wanted and just enjoyed life.
Paul Rutledge of the Public Prosecutor's Office.
She said goodbye to her mother that morning, her mother expecting her to see her in a few hours' time.
Kira normally comes home around 3:15. On this day, she shortcuts across an overgrown vacant lot, known in Australia as an allotment. Just after 4, an anonymous call's made to the Rockhampton police. A female caller shares an ominous tip. Defense lawyer Peter Shields recounts what she reports.
A man whom they had seen the previous day and shortly before the attack as he walked past their house was seen to come up behind a young girl in a school uniform, strike her from behind, run off the allotment and across the street.
Prosecutor Paul Rutledge.
The people across the road were watching all this but had not intervened.
The caller also reveals that the man that struck the child drove a red car onto the allotment. He put something in the trunk, and he drove off. Detective Hickey.
They were able to give a description, a physical description of the offender, including clothing, distinctive yellow shorts, and a white T-shirt.
Detectives are on the scene in minutes and search the vacant lot. Darren Lees reports.
And it was at that point that we found hair, blood, tire impressions from the vehicle that had driven in, and also footprint impressions.
Her shoe was located, her school bag. There certainly was definitive evidence to identify that that child that had been attacked there was, in fact, Kira Steinhardt.
Detectives Hickey and Lees inform Kira's parents that their daughter has been abducted. They immediately reach out to the public.
And a decision was made to release to the media certain details, including the fact that there'd been an abduction of a 9-year-old girl, the general description of the offender and the vehicle, and where the incident occurred.
Journalist Paul Robinson and cameraman Bruce Black pick up the story.
They asked the community for assistance. At that stage, we weren't really sure of her condition or what had happened to her.
We went to the crime scene later on and took shots of the police searching and the SES people and searching the vacant block meticulously, you know, going over it inch by inch. I think most crime scenes are not a pleasant place to be at, but covering a crime scene like this one, where you've got a young 9-year-old girl just walking home from school, you know, attacked like that, I think really strikes at your heart.
Catching the story about the missing girl on the news, a local man makes his way to the crime scene and to detectives Lees and Hickey.
He attended the scene after seeing the media release and actually told us that he believed he knew who the offender was. He could confirm to us that that person was wearing clothing described by the family and can recall seeing a person who had spent time in prison for rape offences.
And the man provides a name. Lenny Fraser.
Leonard John Fraser was a 49-year-old male who'd been in and out of correctional facilities for the majority of his life.
We sent detectives out there straight away, and they were able to confirm that parked in the driveway was a small red vehicle.
Detectives knock on Fraser's door. The man that answers is unforgettable.
He was a scary person. He was big. And he just had that look in his eye.
Fraser and his live-in girlfriend, Chrissy Raitt, get hauled downtown for questioning.
And it was from that point on that we commenced talking about the abduction of Kira Steinhardt.
Fraser's car is processed by forensics.
They use a myriad of tools to assist them, light enhancement techniques, to actually identify possible areas for bloodstaining. Samples are then recorded or swabbed for later DNA examination back in the lab.
What Sergeant Hickey discovers is not good.
Distinctive areas of blood staining are located within the boot of the vehicle, and there was also areas of blood staining located within the cabin of the vehicle.
Detectives turn up the heat on Fraser's live-in girlfriend, Chrissy Raitt.
Chrissy Raitt was a young, intellectually disadvantaged girl who was in a de facto relationship with Fraser at that particular time.
What Chrissy Raitt tells investigators dims the prospects of survival for little Kira Steinhardt. Lawyer Peter Shields explains.
Leonard Fraser and his girlfriend had been visiting an acquaintance only a few minutes' drive from the allotment where the attack took place. He left there at about 3:10 p.m.
A few hours later, Fraser returns, wearing different clothes. He and Raitt then drive to some secluded woods. Detective Lees describes what Chrissy Raitt sees.
And out the vehicle and could see what she described to police as a big doll dressed in yellow shirt and green skirt with blonde hair. It was at that point that Lenny looked back and saw her looking. He dropped the doll and came to the car and punched Chrissy a number of times and told her that if she looked back again that he was going to kill her.
Chrissy believes he will, and she doesn't look up again. But her testimony and the blood in his car allow cops to keep Fraser locked up. Then another call. The detectives go to investigate a crime scene at a run-down hotel.
Queenslander Hotel was a common haunt of vagrant people, homeless types.
The hotel is being torn down. Prosecutor Paul Rutledge describes the horrific scene that workers discover.
You had the picture of someone with extreme force using some sort of weapon, probably a piece of wood, and as they're swinging back, they're casting off the blood around the room. It was a very violent assault.
And there were blood splatters all over the ceiling and all over the other walls. A big patch of blood on the carpet at the base of where that wall was.
There was other evidence of large blood loss within the toilets of the hotel as well. The DNA processing takes some time. Initially, there was no idea who had been the source of the blood at that crime scene.
With Natasha Ryan, Julie Turner, Beverly Lego, and now Kira Steinhardt missing, police wait anxiously for DNA results from the Queenslander crime scene. Meantime, the community mobilizes, still hoping to find a lost Kira.
The search itself was enormous, and the community support we got with that search from a policing perspective, I have never seen anything like it.
But Darren Lees is an experienced investigator with a sinking feeling.
But I think realistically, from a policing point of view, after 24 hours, you realise that it's a murder investigation.
3 long days have passed since Kira Steinhardt crossed that vacant lot. A young man named Joe Doherty calls police, reporting that his 19-year-old girlfriend, Sylvia Benedetti, is missing. Detective Lees.
She was a young girl who was a bit of a street wanderer in and around Rockhampton, also into the drug scene, but very out of character for her to go any more than a day or two without contacting her boyfriend or friends that she knew. And at that point, she hadn't contacted anyone for over a week.
The last she was seen was around 6:30, 7 o'clock at night, sitting in the mall, talking to a man.
Joe Doherty claims the man Sylvia Benedetti's been seen talking to is Leonard Fraser.
Alarm bells did start to ring.
Detective Lees shows Chrissy Raitt a picture of the missing teenager.
She was able to identify that Sylvia was a person who had associated with both her and Lenny Fraser.
Fear for Sylvia Benedetti grows. Detectives dig deep, discovering solid connections between each of the missing women and Leonard Fraser. Julie Turner worked with him at a meat processing plant. Her daughter recalls a conversation she'd had with her mother.
She said she was thinking about moving out of where she was at and sharing a place with a guy. She said, Lenny.
Missing Beverly Lego lived near Fraser, and her boyfriend, Richard Gritz, served prison time with him. Detective Hickey connects the dots.
They were actually neighbours. Beverly Lego lived across the road from Fraser in Mount Morgan.
Natasha Ryan's mother, Jenny, fingers Fraser from a photo lineup. She says both she and her daughter know Fraser.
Fraser, in fact, would transport some of Natasha Ryan's team to the bowling alley, and Natasha's mother would drive them home.
Building connections between the missing women and Fraser is impressive police work. But no bodies have been found, so no charges can be laid. The detectives desperately need harder evidence, and a career criminal named Brett Bignell, who's done time with Fraser, thinks he has a way to provide that hard evidence.
Bignell offered to actually engage Fraser in conversation within the cell to try and elicit from Fraser the whereabouts of Kira Steinhardt.
So Lees and Hickey wire Brett Bignell up. It's not long before the jailbird produces results for the detectives.
Lenny Fraser asked him to get rid of something for him from his house that was hidden in a peg box in the garage. And he told Brett that it was a knife. And he said to Brett that if the police find this, I'm gone.
It was actually recovered from the block of flats where Fraser resided. There were obvious areas of bloodstaining found on that particular knife.
The lab confirms that the blood on the knife belongs to Kira Steinhardt. another forensic expert makes his report about plaster footfall casts. The casts are impressions of footprints found in the vacant lot Kira was snatched from. Darren Lees explains the expert's findings.
He was able to tell us that the offender has a very distinctive foot in that one part of his foot, which is his little toe, doesn't touch the ground when he walks or runs. The impressions that we took from the offender's feet themselves were the same as the impressions that we'd obtained from the track where the offence had taken place.
Lees and Hickey have the murder weapon, crime scene foot impressions, and a vehicle containing blood residue. With this new hard evidence against him, Fraser agrees to assist the investigation. He takes Hickey for a walk in the woods.
He declined to go too close to Kira's final resting place, but he identified the general location without making any substantial comment. A short distance away, they found Kira's body.
It's the worst outcome possible. With a heavy heart, Detective Darren Lees tells Kira's mother, Teresa, the heartbreaking news.
You could actually see the life drain out of her in front of you, in front of your own eyes. Yeah, it wasn't something I'd ever want to relive.
Flowers, notes, and toys pile up in tribute to the innocent girl. The entire community feels her pain. The entire community grieves.
There was thousands and thousands of people from around the Rockhampton community, school children, parents, older people, younger people, just people who wanted to come and pay their last respects to a beautiful girl who didn't deserve to die in the way that she did.
Fraser is charged with murdering Kira Steinhardt, and Hickey learns the lab report about that blood in Fraser's car has arrived. It's Kira Steinhardt's blood, all right. And blood from the missing Sylvia Benedetti.
So immediately, investigators were aware that two of the missing females had actually shed blood within Fraser's car.
Not only that, but Lees also learned that it's Sylvia's blood at that grisly crime scene inside the Queenslander Hotel. The detective sends in a search team.
A full search of that hotel was done and located in an old freezer down covered in old grotty water was the clothing belonging to Sylvia Benedetti.
The evidence is piling up, but Hickey and Lees face a big problem. Though they've established the connections between the missing women and Fraser, there's no other physical evidence of foul play.
In the absence of a body, it's very difficult to progress.
I think, you know, everybody realised, look, we probably are looking at a serial killer here, and he is probably responsible for the disappearances of all these women.
Fraser is placed in protective custody, safe from the brand of jailhouse justice inmates are known for when it comes to child killers.
The Moreton Bay Correctional Facility was a protective facility. It housed predominantly child sex offenders. The other inmates may have had pedophile-type backgrounds themselves, but it was different to be in there for the murder of a child. And it was within this correctional facility that he bumped into a former inmate from New South Wales, one Alan John Quinn.
As Detective Hickey explains, Fraser seems to need a friend inside.
Alan Quinn and Fraser had spent some time together in Sydney prisons, in particular Parramatta Jail. Fraser, in an effort to seek out some sort of an ally, he approached Quinn and tried to remind Quinn of their earlier dealings.
So Quinn reaches out to the man who put him behind bars, Detective John Keefe.
He had actually charged Quinn with fraud-related offences. Quinn had told him that Fraser was talking about multiple murders which he had committed.
Quinn has personal reasons to accept Fraser's overtures of friendship. Prosecutor Paul Rutledge.
Quinn was just terribly affected by the murder of Kira Steinhardt and told me that what he wanted to do was to give something back to the community.
Fraser starts singing to his new pal.
He started making certain admissions to Alan, and Alan volunteered to police to record the conversations with Lenny over a large period of time.
For 4 months, Quinn listens. Fraser talks and talks and talks.
Quinn was able to provide sufficient detail as to the methods of killing and detail of the crime scene, in particular room 13 at the Queensland Hotel.
That's the room where naked Sylvia Benedetti was beaten to death. Fraser finally stands trial for the murder of Kira Steinhardt and goes down hard. Prosecutor Rutledge makes certain of that.
As well as life imprisonment, I applied for an indefinite term of imprisonment. The effect of the indefinite term of imprisonment was that he could not be released on parole unless he was found no longer to be a danger to the community, which in Fraser's case was highly unlikely.
When I was a kid, I always remember being so excited to go to the grocery store with my mom and dad because there was always that amazing moment where I could pick out my very own cereal. Yes, it was sugar-heavy and delicious with no nutritional value, but I was a kid. Why would I care about nutrition? I wanted that sugar. Now, as an adult, I walk down those same cereal aisles and see my childhood cereal favorites, knowing I can look but can't touch. Because they're filled with sugar and offer nothing nutritious to get me through my day. The problem is, they taste so good. I've been so torn for so long, but not anymore, thanks to Magic Spoon. Magic Spoon's delicious variety pack of 4 flavors include cocoa, fruity, frosted, and peanut butter. They're all delicious on their own, but I even like to mix them together sometimes. The cocoa with the peanut butter? So good. Magic Spoon has 0 grams of sugar, 13 to 14 grams of protein, and only 4 net grams of carbs in each serving. Only 140 calories a serving, plus it's keto-friendly, gluten-free, grain-free, soy-free, and low-carb. Go to magicspoon.com/MT to grab a variety pack and try it today. And be sure to use our promo code MT at checkout to save $5 off your order. And Magic Spoon is so confident in their product, it's backed with a 100% happiness guarantee. So if you don't like it for any reason, they'll refund your money, no questions asked. Remember, get your next delicious bowl of guilt-free cereal at magicspoon.com/MT and use the code MT to save $5 off. Thank you, Magic Spoon, for sponsoring this episode. Leonard Fraser is going upriver for good for the murder of Kira Steinhardt. And Alan Quinn keeps the convicted kid killer talking, but he'll only share stories about crimes involving adult victims. Detective Hickey.
But he limited his confessions to that. He didn't want Quinn to think less of him.
Fraser started talking to Quinn because he thought it was to his advantage. He wanted to convince the authorities that he had a mental health illness.
The talkative killer keeps talking and being recorded in high fidelity. Fraser wants to be declared crazy because his chances of surviving in the psych ward are a whole bunch better than in Gen Pop. But is it truth or fiction? Detective Hickey shares what he's heard.
In most graphic detail, Fraser would outline how he abducted, tortured, and eventually murdered the 4 women. And it was all recorded and capable of being played back to a jury in the Supreme Court trial.
Fraser gave a number of stories about Natasha Ryan, but essentially he claimed that he had killed her on a farm outside of Rockhampton and had buried her body on that farm.
Fraser claims that Natasha told him she was pregnant with his child.
With Julie Turner, he told Quinn that as they were driving along, he had simply struck her in the face and the blow had killed her. Fraser told Quinn that he'd killed Beverly Lego out at the Nankin Creek area. He also told Quinn that he'd actually tossed the handbag into the Fitzroy River to put the police off the trail. He claimed he tied a rope around her neck and that he strangled her.
Fraser recounts the brutal killing of Sylvia Benedetti inside the filthy Queenslander Hotel.
Fraser eventually told Quinn that Benedetti's skull had been crushed in, that there was blood all over the room.
The killer also reveals where he dumped the dead Sylvia Benedetti. But cops already know where Sylvia is. In November, surfers had stumbled on her remains as they hiked a beachside trail. DNA testing and tooth fragments confirmed it was Sylvia. Quinn offers Fraser an out.
Quinn suggested, basically, give up the bodies and you might get your wish.
Fraser goes for it. Quinn gives Detective Hickey the word.
Quinn had instructed me that Fraser was, in fact, willing to accompany me to Rockhampton and disclose the whereabouts of the bodies. But at that stage, he still was not actually confessing. The first location he directed me to was known as Nankin Creek. We subsequently located the skeletal remains of Beverly Lego. And then we continued on to a road, which was an area closer to the township of Yeppoon. We walked several hundred metres. There was the skeletal remains of Julie Turner.
Fraser's saying nothing about where Natasha Ryan may be, but why he's being coy isn't clear.
Fraser was happy to disclose the whereabouts of his mature victims, but was somewhat reticent to be linked to the murder of another child.
But Fraser's going down. His knowledge of specific crime details seals the deal.
Fraser was charged with a further 3 counts of murder in relation to adult women. He was also charged with the murder of Natasha Ryan, the young 14-year-old girl.
Fraser's trial ramps up in early 2003. Compelled to testify is Kylie Elder, Julie Turner's grieving daughter. She shares her experience.
I had to give evidence first during the trial. It was really hard. He just had no, like, emotions on his face. He just sat back and took it all and, like, lapped up all the attention.
Prosecutor Paul Rutledge agrees.
The trial of Lenny Fraser was unique in Queensland because it was the first trial of a serial killer in Queensland.
The first week of the trial draws huge media attention. In the second week, a major twist. Detective Daryl Howe is sent to enforce a witness summons on Scott Black, the missing Natasha Ryan's boyfriend. The detective asks to look around his apartment. Detective Darren Lees.
She was found alive and well. Daryl opened a cupboard door in one of the bedrooms and Natasha was crouched down in the cupboard.
Scott's been hiding Natasha for years. The prosecutor makes this announcement mid-trial.
I told the court that I'm pleased to inform the court that Leonard John Fraser is not guilty of the murder of Natasha Ryan. Natasha is alive.
The trial continues, minus the Natasha Ryan murder charge. On May 9, 2003, a verdict is reached. The efforts of Detective David Hickey and his task force finally pay off.
Fraser was eventually found guilty for the murders of Sylvia Benedetti, the murder of Beverly Lego, and they found him guilty of manslaughter of Julie Turner.
Fraser gets 3 more life sentences in addition to the life sentence for killing Kira Steinhardt. Prosecutor Paul Rutledge slams Fraser with another indefinite lockup, so no possibility of parole, ever. But his time inside is brief. 4 years later, Leonard Fraser dies a prisoner. Kylie Elder.
Sometimes I feel like he got out of it easy, and he doesn't have to sit in there every day and think about what he's done. I just hope my kids, when they get older, they understand what I've had to do and put up with. I feel like I've missed most of my kids' young years of growing up. For having to deal with it all.
Prosecutor Paul Rutledge.
I've got no doubt that Fraser would have killed and killed and killed. Fraser was a classic psychopath. He was a violent man.
And this from lead investigator David Hickey.
He was the worst of the worst.
See you next time for more Murder Time.
Simon Decker wrote and produced A Brutal Bludgeoner, working with files from the television series Crime Stories, Blood Lies and Alibis, and Catching Killers. Our executive producer is Ron Getz. Our supervising producer is Robert Laughlin, and our technical producer is Joe Watts. Crime Stories, Murder Time, is a production of Partners in Motion.